thank you for tuning in to IGH 260. Today's broadcast, lesson number 5 of week number 16, studying Matthew chapter 16, part of a one chapter per week, 260 week, 5-year long study of the New Testament. As we get started, these reminders. To access all of our materials, always free, click the word free at internationalgospelhour.com. To receive a list of these materials, just email us at free@ighradio.com. For text updates, text the word IGH free to 55222. That's IGHFREE, all one word, text IGH free to 55222. Two great ways to study God's Word. A free, self-paced online program. Get started by going to igh.worldbibleschool.org or click the online courses link at internationalgospelhour.com. To study by mail, call this toll-free number, 1-855-IGH-6988, to receive our free 30-lesson Bible study series, or use the contact form at internationalgospelhour.com. Let's get back into Matthew chapter 16. Here's where we were at the end of our last study. Jesus stated two key things in Matthew chapter 16, verse 4. One, a principle, and the other, a prophecy. The principle, Jesus told the Pharisees and the Sadducees that a wicked and adulterous generation seeks after a sign. The prophecy, no sign shall be given to it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. These two statements appear contradictory. Further reading and further thinking will prove that they are not. The gospel accounts record many of Jesus' miracles, also called signs. The first time that we encounter the word sign appears in Matthew chapter 12, verses 38 and 39, where we read, "Then some of the scribes and Pharisees answered, saying, Teacher, we want to see a sign from you. But he answered and said to them, An evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, and no sign will be given to it except the sign of the prophet Jonah." Does that sound familiar? It should. We did not mistakenly read our text, Matthew 16. What we read came from Matthew chapter 12. It sounds very close to what we read in the opening verses of Matthew 16, but the two passages come from different contexts. Why does it sound so close to what we read in the opening verses of Matthew 16? Two reasons. First, there's an overlap between those who raised that question in Matthew 12 with those who raised the same question here in Matthew 16. In Matthew 12, it was the scribes and the Pharisees. And in Matthew 19, it was the Pharisees and the Sadducees. The Pharisees were mentioned in both instances. And that brings us to the second reason. The Pharisees continued to ask this question. The wording in Matthew 16:4, seeks after a sign, stresses the habitual action of seeking a sign. The point, their desire for a conclusive sign to prove that Jesus was the Messiah was ongoing. But it was not just ongoing here in Matthew 16. Jesus used the same language in this text to the Pharisees and the Sadducees that he did to the scribes and the Pharisees in Matthew chapter 12. It's not that Jesus did not offer signs as proof of his identity. It's not that Jesus did not offer convincing signs to prove his identity. Jesus did that repeatedly. It's that none of the signs convinced and convicted, let alone changed the character of the scribes, the Pharisees, or the Sadducees. They wanted more, thus indicating that what Jesus had done to this point failed to bring them to believe in him. And that's why Jesus said, "An evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign." The demand for ongoing signs was tantamount to saying, "Nothing that you have done has been convincing yet. What else do you have?" And yet, many others had already come to faith based on the many signs that Jesus had already provided. We repeat what we noted earlier. It was not an intellectual problem that kept the religious leaders from faith. It was a problem of will. It was a problem of their pride. That's why Jesus chastised them at the beginning of the chapter. They recognized and they grasped the meaning of signs, evidence in the sky. But they failed to grasp the meaning of the signs that Jesus provided during the course of his ministry. And then there's that sign that Jesus offered, the sign of the prophet Jonah. Let's think about that sign. Rather than providing the kind of sign that the Pharisees and the Sadducees asked for, Jesus introduced a sign of his own choosing. This sign, one from the distant past, was rooted in the biblical narrative of Jonah, the prophet that God had sent to Nineveh. Remember that this setting, Matthew 16, was the second time that Jesus was challenged about producing a sign. In that first passage, Matthew chapter 12, which we just alluded to, we glean additional information about the one that Jesus offered, the sign of the prophet Jonah. In that text we read, "For as Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth. The men of Nineveh will rise up in the judgment with this generation and condemn it, because they repented at the preaching of Jonah. And indeed, a greater than Jonah is here." That's Matthew 12, 40 and 41. This text, beyond telling us that the sign was rooted in the biblical account of Jonah, specifically tells us how that biblical account applied. It was not about Jonah's preaching to the city of Nineveh. It was not about Jonah's initial attempt to escape his responsibility to go to Nineveh. It was all about the amount of time that Jonah spent in the belly of the great fish. Jesus emphasized that time with these words, "For as Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth." Though the exact parallel was not explicitly stated here in Matthew 12, the reference to 3 days and 3 nights as it applied to Jonah equaled the length of time that Jesus would spend in the grave after his crucifixion. That's explicitly stated elsewhere. Matthew chapter 16, verse 21 teaches that Jesus would be raised the third day. That thought's repeated many times in the gospel narratives. Additionally, Jesus compared the response of the men of Nineveh to the scribes and the Pharisees in Matthew chapter 12, a comparison that would have applied equally to the Pharisees and the Sadducees in Matthew chapter 16. Jesus stated that the men of Nineveh demonstrated a greater response to Jonah's preaching than did either of the two groups that asked for a sign. Why? Because they repented at the preaching of Jonah, meaning that they responded appropriately as God expected them to Jonah's message. Jesus' hearers in Matthew 12 and in Matthew 16 did not respond appropriately. There's another detail that's missing from Matthew 16 that we see in Matthew chapter 12. The question that the scribes and the Pharisees asked Jesus on that occasion appears to have been prompted by Jesus' scathing rebuke of them earlier in the chapter. Remember, earlier in Matthew 12, starting in verse 22, Jesus healed a man that was demon-possessed, blind, and mute. That prompted the multitudes in amazement to ask, "Could this be the Son of David?" Chapter 12, verse 23. The next verse, Matthew 12, 24, says, "Now when the Pharisees heard it, they said, 'This fellow does not cast out demons except by Beelzebub, the ruler of the demons.'" That's an interesting statement. First, it does not tell us that they were taken by surprise when Jesus healed this man. This was not the first time that Jesus healed someone in Matthew's record, nor was it the first time that the religious leaders had witnessed one of Jesus' healing miracles. That's not to say that they fully appreciated or understood or accepted what Jesus did here, but they were certainly privy to seeing this type of healing before. Second, the text says, "When the Pharisees heard it." The word hear does not apply to their hearing the man speak who was once mute, but rather to what they heard the multitudes ask. The multitudes asked, after witnessing this miracle, could this be the son of David? That's what prompted them to accuse Jesus of casting out demons by the power of Beelzebub. They were countering, they were attacking what the multitude seemed to have been thinking. The multitudes thought, this man, Jesus, just healed a man. Maybe he's the promised son of David. What could be a more diametrically opposed explanation than a possible messianic interpretation of what Jesus did? Yes, that's it. Rather than giving God, through the messianic fulfillment of the coming Son of David credit, we will claim that Jesus healed this man by the power of the prince of demons. You cannot get any further away from what the multitudes believed than that. Jesus, knowing what they were thinking, excoriated them logically, spiritually, morally, and practically. First, Jesus showed that their reasoning, using the term very loosely here, was flawed. Kingdoms divided against themselves will not stand. Satan divided against himself will not stand. Thus, Beelzebub, the prince of demons, does not cast out his own kind. He does not cast out demons. Second, instead of working in concert with Beelzebub, Jesus declared that he cast out demons by the Spirit of God. And if that's the case, and it was, of course, then God's kingdom had come. Third, Jesus stated that the only way that he could cast out demons, using the robbing the strong man's house analogy, was that he, Jesus, must be stronger, more powerful than the forces of Satan and the power of demons. Fourth, Jesus accused them of blaspheming the Spirit by alleging that what he, the Son of David, the Son of God, did was done by Beelzebub rather than by the Spirit of God. Fifth, Jesus told his opponents that they would be held accountable for everything they said, including speaking against the Son of Man. Their words would justify their end, their destiny. And sixth, Jesus said that they were, in effect, evil. What they said about Jesus, the multitudes, Jesus' disciples, and others, indicated that they had a serious heart problem. In our next broadcast, we will take up at this point and continue our study of Matthew 16. This reminder as we close, to enroll in our free, self-paced online Bible study, go to igh.worldbibleschool.org. We hope that you can join us as we study God's Word together in our next broadcast.